Right, thank you. Thanks to Erica for organising this great event again, and for bringing me back to this space, which I've been missing for a while since the London beginnings of it. And thanks for the prompt to think about looking. It's become a fascinating thing, kind of point of departure for me in terms of thinking about theatre and the presence of animals in theatre. So I've been writing and rewriting this talk as I've been here and thinking, having more and more ideas of what to say. And it's great to be like presenting next to David, because one of the concerns that I've had working, not in the circus, but in contemporary theatre practice, is precisely this division in theatre and performance studies between, when thinking about animals, between the circus and all of that, and then the serious theatre that goes on in both commercial and non-commercial stages. And I think the class division that you've just mentioned there of the circus and who it appeals to, and the kinds of work that I'm talking about, it's still pertinent and important to think about. So, I'll read this. So my research on the presence of the animal in contemporary theatre and performance practice began about 5 years ago when I was doing work on the international festival circuit, and kind of began to realise how many animals, and especially, or how often certain animals, and especially certain live animals, were beginning to appear on stage. So when I started looking outside the festival circuit, I realised that these live animals were actually everywhere. That they were coming in from the text-based theatre of Carol Churchill to Edward Albee. They were in the musicals, Annie, Oliver, etc., etc. And since then, I've become kind of fascinated by the presence of the live animal. And I should say that my paper focuses on the live animal, and also a slight change in the title, in the theatre rather than in performance, so in what we would consider kind of traditional theatre spaces. And after 5 years of thinking, which is a very short period of time, but after 5 years of thinking about these questions, I've come to a somehow disenchanted position in, that makes me believe that the animal brings a lot to the theatre, but that the theatre gives very little back to the animal. And I believe that in general terms, the proliferation of animals, live animals, of animal presence in contemporary theatre does not necessarily coincide with an interest in the question of the animal as such. And I've come to agree with Rachel Rosenthal that with very few exceptions, the presence of animals in theatre rarely translates in, and I quote her, artists using animals in a way that is respectful or humane. With this in mind, I want to think about how some of this theatre work produces ways of looking at animals that exemplify that disregard for the conditions in which the animal's participation in the theatre takes place. And I do this by beginning an exploration on how and why we look at animals in the theatre, and what do we look at and what do we see when they occupy the stage. So what do we do when the live animals that are regularly part of theatre productions, and I'm thinking mostly about dogs, horses, cats, snakes, rabbits, chickens, cows, ducks, what do we do when these animals appear live on stage? We look at them, and we really look at them, and W.C. Fields knew this when he was saying I've never worked with children and animals. He kind of encapsulated, referred precisely to that capacity that the animal has to steal the show. And of course we look at these animals because in the theatre, because we go to the theatre to look. Etymologically, theatron is the place for looking. But I believe that the animal captivates the audience's attention because it is, as Nick Rideout has suggested, such an improbable presence in the theatre. Because it does not belong there. And Rideout has famously explored this, talking about the presence of a mouse in a performance of Harold Pinter's The Caretaker in London in 2000, when he describes watching the play and seeing a mouse cross the stage under a bed in the performance and then coming out again from the, under the bed onto the other bed. And Michael Gambon is playing, Hodgett at that point has to actually move his foot to let the mouse come by. And the discussion that ensues is in the audience is, was that animal, was that mouse an actor? Was that mouse part of the performance? And we could not help but wonder whether it had anything to do with it. And then what happens, I think, is that its accidental presence has become part of the performance matrix, inserted in the theatre's conventions of representation that ask us to believe that what we see on stage, is not real. So we're not seeing a mouse, we're seeing a representation of a mouse. So we're seeing a mouse act like a mouse rather than a mouse. And animals in performance belong to the circus. Of course, I'm saying this ironically. The aquapark pools, the bullfighting arenas, the rodeos, and the zoos, which I consider a performance event. But they are a strange presence in the contemporary stages of international theatre festivals, the commercial theatres of the West End or Broadway, national theatres, fringe venues, etc. And as Rydell suggests, and I quote him, the theatre is all about humans coming to face with other humans and either liking it or not liking it. So the animal clearly has no place in such communication. Not only should it not be there because it cannot be in its own interests to be, but it should not be there because this particular kind of being there, when it should not, is what we expect to find in the circus. And we certainly, and I hope that I'm understanding this ironically from Rydell, we certainly do not want the theatre contaminated by that kind of association. Well, of course, these spectacles happen hand in hand in history. To me, our insistent looking at the animal on stage comes from our struggle to understand their presence and participation in the theatre. And this links back to ideas that we were discussing yesterday about how looking might be about not understanding. And so I think our struggle to understand its presence comes from that, from this idea that we don't know why it's there, but also because it's brought about by the fact that in many occasions the animal lack of understanding of its own being there is also visible to the audience. This lack of understanding is especially visible in animals who are not used to the stage in general because they're not animal performers. Or in performing animals that are either not part of the rehearsal process at all, that come in only at the point of encounter with the audience, or not for very long. And this is usually due to financial reasons, that it's very expensive to hire animals, so they might not be part of the 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 3 months, but they only come in 2 days before the opening night. Regardless of the stage audience arrangement, while the spectator's gaze is encouraged to roam freely over the performance space, her gaze is always confined by the limits of this space. And these limits that define where we look and what we look at in the theatre are also the limits that produce the confined space that the animal inhabits while on stage, and the boundaries that shape its presence. And I think it functions similarly to the cage in the zoo. This is a space that more often than not the animal attempts to escape. My experience taking part in rehearsals, including live animals, has demonstrated that live animals in the theatre spend much of their time on stage trying to work out, to the despair of actors, designers, technicians and directors, how to leave the performance space. The methods used to keep them there in order to ensure their visibility, food, change, cages, handlers, etc., are assimilated into the theatricality of the event and in turn take on different meanings. And I find this assimilation presents some difficult questions. When the audience enter Robert Wilson's production of Life and Death of Marina Abramovich, which is a show that started in 2011, they're faced with a stage crammed with oversized bones. Minutes after, the auditorium darkens, and our gauge is already directed to the only area that is lit in the theatre space. And a group of Great Danes enter and begin to sniff over the bones. The Great Danes, as many as 10, frantically move around the bones. What we see is a pack of hungry dogs hovering over human remains, so we are kind of encouraged to think that these are Marina Abramovich remains from the title of her death. The dogs continues coming and going off the stage makes the audience realize that in fact what is keeping the dogs there is not the bones, but the treats that members of the crew keep throwing onto the stage from the sides of the theatre. So food is a common method food is a common method for keeping animals on stage, and the Chihuahuas and English Bulldogs, and this is the cast of Legally Blonde in London. So the Chihuahuas and English Bulldogs that play the parts of Bruiser and Rufus in Legally Blonde, the musical, can consume large quantities of beef jerky for small queues, and chicken and hamburgers for big queues and curtain calls during the 8 weekly performances of the show in any of its UK and US productions. And if you're interested, you can buy their treats and their wardrobe on their online shop as well. So directors, actors and designers work hard to disguise food, and with it, the fact that the animal on stage is being tricked to be there. Their methods on stage and off stage create an illusion that the animal is willing to participate, or more importantly, that the question of will does not pertain. And I was thinking about Vincent's talk yesterday about the issue of reward, and what questions does it bring about in terms of the difference between rewarding the animal in scientific experimentation and rewarding the animal to perform tricks in performance. So perhaps the need for the beef jerky is an indication that Kelly and Frankie, who are the dogs that take the part of Bruiser, is that what they're asked to do, as fascinating as it might be for us, is actually really boring for them. And that, you know, what do they think about having to jump in and out of a pink designer bag for 2 hours on cue? So what kinds of questions are the directors and artists, trainers, etc., avoiding to ask to the animal by this constant provision of treats? Other methods of keeping the animal on stage perform similar roles in theatricalizing the animals partaking in the theatre. And the work of Società Raffaello Sanzio and Rodrigo García, whom I'm going to talk about briefly now, presents a very problematic theatricalization of those modes of managing the animal, the live animal on stage. And this is because I feel that these methods present the animal, I'll read it, produce the theatricalization in what I believe to be a more problematic ways, because of the subordination of the animal to the work's dramaturgical and aesthetics choices. So Inferno opens with the piece's own director, and perhaps what I'll do is, if that's all right, I'll show the video and then I don't have to describe it, and it's more interesting.
Je m'appelle Romeo Castellucci.
Okay, so that is the opening scene of the play, and I think the dogs are the main focus of Inferno's opening scene, which is a piece concerned with highlighting the boundaries between the real and the theatrical, and it demonstrates that by opening, by kind of putting the whole action of the piece into giant lit inverted commas from the very beginning to the very end of the piece. So we're looking at it as piece of theatre. We're encouraged to look at it as a piece of theatre. And it is precisely the production's explicit theatricality, its hyper-theatricality, what serves to conceal the reality of the dog's treatment on stage. In my view, the scenes, what you've just seen, dramaturgical choices, are disguised as practical decisions, and I believe this to be a problem. The dramaturgy of the attack follows the basics of the Aristotle's dramaturgical model. This allows Castellucci to produce a spectacle that calls to the audience's pity and fear through the representations of the animals, human and non-human, as subjects who cannot escape their fate. In practice, however, what this entails is the chaining of the animal and the protection of the human. The production expects the audience to assume that chains are needed to keep the Alsatians in place. And I don't know if you saw, but at the front, there were about eight Alsatians chained, who are entered on stage and chained to the floor, while the other two in the production, so there were three dogs that attacked Castellucci. So the production expects the audience to assume that chains are needed to keep the Alsatians in place. What would we do if one of them jumped onto the auditorium? And that the suit will stop the dogs biting into Castellucci's flesh. But these practical decisions are indeed dramaturgical ones, and the scene adds little to the production's production's exploration of the real and the theatrical, and is instead, I believe, a representation of human control over the animal of the kind that we find in the circus. That form of entertainment, not an art form, of course, that cannot, as Rideout ironically reminds us, contaminate the theatre. So in this opening scene, what I think we find is a disjunction between what the act of looking in the theatre requires us to see, a violent dog attack on a human, and what we look at, a group of Alsatians whose actions are orchestrated to produce infernus and intense atmosphere. And Rodrigo García, who's an Argentinian director that I've been working with for quite a while, presents similar problems.
Okay,
very quickly. So the animals in the production of Approche à l'idée de ma fiance, this production that was presented in Annecy, were central to its production. There were four chickens and one turtle that were there for the entirety of the rehearsal process, and were essential to the creation of beauty within the piece. When I was in Annecy for most of that period, I witnessed once again how animals participate in life performance before, during, and after the productions. During my 10 days in Annecy, I watched while the chickens and turtle were moved from cages to stage every day, while they were locked once the rest of the crew went to the hotels after rehearsals. I saw the animals being looked after or not by the actors, and was witness to a conversation about whose responsibility actually was to look after the turtle whose shell was was deteriorating since its arrival at the theatre. I saw actors and directors look for the animals during rehearsals because they stubbornly disappeared backstage or around the sitting unit. And I watched the turtles attempt to jump off stage every single day, and only succeeding once, and perceived this as a sign of its reluctance to take part in the performance. For García, Approche is again like Inferno, an exploration of hyper-theatricality. It asks actors to be, rather than to pretend to be someone else. It interrupts linear narratives. It introduces real chickens, real animals, a turtle. It disrupts the automatic transformation of subjects into signs that the theatrical event produces. However, and this is a picture of the rehearsal, and another one. I would argue that the piece is duplicitous in this exposure of the theatrical, since it encourages its audience to look at the animal as a beautiful, moving, breathing object on stage, its paraphernalia, cages, food, etc., transformed to participate in the construction of that beauty. So that is rehearsal, that is production. So the images, I hope, kind of, that is production as well, kind of give you a sense of the transformation of the animal between what we don't see and what we end up seeing when we see the production on stage. So we are asked to turn a blind eye to the animal's material conditions in relation to its participation in performance, to forget about the cages, the food, and what keeps the animal there in the same. And we look at them, or we ask to look at them, as beautiful objects that form the background on which human life takes place. And Maika Bleeker reminds us in her work Visuality in the Theatre that there is no such a thing as just looking anymore. The animal in the theatre is not just there to be looked at, since looking is an active process. Looking appears to alter the thing that we look at and transforms the one looking. The spectator is involved in the construction of what she sees through memory, fantasy, desire, the unconscious, passion, etc. In the theatre, the moment in which we realise that what we are seeing is make-believe, theatricality is exposed. The failure to convince is as authentic is revealed. And I, like Bleeker, think that the theatre is still today struggling to shake off its association to objective looking, since indications of the viewer being implicated in what is seen can easily appear as merely the product of what they are doing for us. And like her, I also believe that there is a need for the theatre spectator to reclaim her participation in the making of theatre, in the act of looking at works of theatre, in order to break away from the idea of looking objectively that transforms the audience into a uniform mass. This might allow us to recognise the live animal on stage this might allow us to recognise that while the live animal on stage might be presented as an intrusion of the real that exposes the theatre's theatricality, the actuality of the live animal, its realness, is actually hidden and matrixed into the theatrical event, thus hiding a theatre the conditions of its the theatre conditions of its being there. Thank you.